Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Leviticus chapter 25, second part of the chapter, verses 23 through 55, in which is discussed the laws of redemption. Our context is this. In the first half of the chapter, verses 1 through 22, we looked at the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee. So let's start now with verses 23 through 25 of Leviticus 25. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. Now, the whole point of this is that you cannot sell land permanently outside of your tribe. That's why it says in verse 23, the land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. If the land was sold permanently, was not redeemed back into the original seller's hands, that means the property of all the tribes would get all mixed up. It would not be clear which tribe was which, and then all the prophecies wouldn't come to pass. Jesus would not necessarily come from the tribe of Judah, as was prophesied. And so the land had to stay in the tribal, in the various tribal names. Now, how was that accomplished? By redemption. Now, there's three ways that the land could come back into the original tribe that it belonged to. The first way is redemption by a kinsman redeemer. Let's say an owner sells his land just to get cash, or as the usual case, he was in debt to somebody, so he would alienate the land to the creditor in payment of the debt, and so the land would be alienated out of his title. Well, the kinsman redeemer, the nearest relative of the seller or the debtor, the nearest relative could then go to the purchaser of the land and say, I want to buy this land back. It's going to come back into the family. Now, the original seller wouldn't get his land back, but the kinsman redeemer would get the land, and therefore the land would be back into the tribe because the kinsman redeemer is a kinsman. He's in the same tribe. So that's the first way the original tribe gets its land back. The second is redemption by the seller. In other words, let's say the seller sells his land in payment of a debt to a creditor, and so the debtor seller has lost his land, but let's say he makes some money and he gets out of his financial straits and he has the money now, he can just go back to the person who bought the land and say, I want it back. I'm going to redeem it. Here's your money. And he gets the land back, and the land comes back into the same tribe. Now, the third way that the land could permanently end up in its original tribal home is through the year of Jubilee, because if the land has never been redeemed and a buyer has got the land, he's never been subject to a redemption purchase by anybody, kinsman redeemer or the original seller. But the year of Jubilee arrives every 50 years, and the land automatically goes back to the seller and ends up back in the original tribe. Now, there was one exception to this rule that the land always came back to the original tribe, and that was land that was dedicated to the priest. Now, if land is dedicated to the priest or consecrated to the priest, the land does get alienated from the original tribe's holdings. Now, the process is described in Leviticus 27, and it's a little bit complicated, but just to summarize it now, we'll talk about it in more detail when I get to Leviticus 27, but just to summarize it, if land is given or consecrated to a priest, the consecrator, the donor of the land, he can redeem it and get it back if he adds 20% of the purchase price. So the Levite would make some money on the deal. It wouldn't like he was losing the land, would not be such a bad deal. But if the seller did not redeem the field in the year of Jubilee, the land does not come back to the seller's tribe. It stays with the priest. So there's your one exception. Usually the land always ends up in the original tribe, but not when you give land to a priest. Now, God gives the reason why the land should not be sold permanently. He said, for the land is mine, verse 23, for the land is mine, and you are but aliens and sojourners with me. In other words, if you own land permanently, you don't think like an alien because it's your land. You're going to have it forever. But God says, no, it's not your land. It's my land. You just stand here at my sufferance. So that means that even a people such as Israel, as land focused as they were nevertheless still aliens. A buyer of property would be like an alien. his possession wasn't permanent. It could be redeemed at any time. And of course, this is a good object lesson for us. Nothing we have in this life, including our land, is permanent. It could be taken from us at any time. The only thing that's permanent in this world is the kingdom of God. Now, verse 25 says that if a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. And notice that's not an option. That's is to come. He must come, buy back, to redeem the property that has been sold to a buyer. Now, who is this nearest kinsman? This is the famous kinsman redeemer. I think the King James translates it that way. First of all, he is a kinsman. He's related. And it's the nearest kinsman, the closest relative available, has got to come back and buy the land. Now, the nearest kinsman is illustrated. The practice of being a nearest kinsman is illustrated in a couple of scriptures. Jeremiah 32, 6 through 9. And Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Behold, Hanamel the son of Shallum, your uncle is coming to you, saying, Buy for yourself my field, which is Anathoth, for you have the right of redemption to buy it." Apparently, Jeremiah's cousin Hanamel had gotten himself into financial difficulty, and it says, "Jeremiah, come buy my field. You have the right of redemption." I would say it's more like the duty of redemption. And so Jeremiah bought the field. And the most famous case of the right of redemption is the story of Ruth and Boaz. Ruth 4, verses 1 through 4. "Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by." That's Ruth's kinsman redeemer. "So he said, Turn aside, friend, sit down here." Boaz said that to him, and the kinsman redeemer turned aside and sat down. Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then Boaz said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi has come back from Moab. She had to sell her land, so I thought to inform you, buy it back. Redeem it so she can have some money, so she can have some land." And then he says, "If you redeem it, deem it. But if not, then I'll redeem it, for I am after you." That means he's the next closest kinsman redeemer. And apparently they had the duty. They had the law was worked out such that if the first nearest kinsman redeemer refused to redeem, then the next one would, and so forth. Now, in the story of Ruth, Boaz not only was the kinsman redeemer of her mother Naomi's land, but also Boaz redeemed Ruth's land and then married her. But that's the duty of marriage was something that was added on to the original idea of the kinsman redeemer. Now, kinsman redeemer is a type of Christ. Why? Because Christ he's kin to us. Why? Because he was a man, and he is our redeemer because he bought us out of the bondage to sin. So he's our kinsman redeemer. So we have a good type here. By the way, the Hebrew word is often carried over into English untranslated. It's Goel, G-O-E-L. I hope I pronounced that right. I like kinsman redeemer better. We go down to Leviticus 25, verses 26 through 28. "Or in case a man has no kinsman, but so recovers his means so as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the years since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and so return to his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of Jubilee. But at the Jubilee it shall revert, that he may return to his property." Now, this is not the case of redemption of sold land by a kinsman redeemer, but rather redemption by the man who sold the property, the debtor. He's usually a debtor. He sold the property, and now he finds means sufficient for its redemption. He gets more money somehow, and so he then redeems the land himself. Now, verse 27 and 28 talk about calculating the price, and it's confusing if you don't understand the year of Jubilee. We remember now that any land sold in Israel shrank in value approximately 1/49th every year, because every year that goes by, you're closer to the year of Jubilee, in which case a purchaser of the land had to give it back to the original seller when the year of Jubilee automatically redeemed land, and therefore the land would be worthless to a buyer. Well, if you bought some land in the first year of Jubilee, you got 49 years worth of use of the land. But if you bought it in the 49th year of Jubilee, you got 1 year. So obviously the price is going to go down every year. And so this is talking about how to calculate the redemption price. If the seller of the land redeems at the very end of the Jubilee period, Well, then he doesn't have to pay very much. And that makes sense because the buyer has had the use of the land for many, many years. He had to pay a full price for it. He got the use of the land for 49 years. Now, when he's selling it, he gets a lousy price for it because there's only a year or so left in the until the year of Jubilee. He gets a lousy price, but you got to remember he had all those years of use of the land. And so the whole thing is totally fair, totally economical, totally rational. Likewise, from the buyer's, from the redeemer's point of view, the seller who is redeeming the property, from his point of view, he only has to pay a little bit if he's close to the year of Jubilee, but on the other hand, he's lost the use of the property for many, many years. Now, the right of redemption could be exercised at any time. Now, think about this. That means that a buyer of land could lose his land at any time. What's that going to do to his incentive to do long-term improvements on the land? I don't think anybody would. I think that using simple agricultural techniques back then, it wouldn't really matter. I don't know, though, if you planted fruit trees and such, that takes 2, 3, 4 years before you get the use of the fruit, and then all of a sudden the land's taken away from you. I presume that he would get a higher price for the land if that happened. I don't know. It seems to me that God's religious reasons for the redemption laws trump the economic ones. And I'm sure that the price that the buyer had to pay for the land was discounted because the buyer knew he might lose it at any time. He couldn't make long-term improvements on it, so he would pay less for the land. So I'm sure it all worked out in the marketplace. We go now to Leviticus 25, verses 29 through 31. Likewise, if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, then his redemption right remains valid until a full year from its sale. His right of redemption lasts a full year. But if it is not bought back for him within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city passes permanently to its purchaser through his generations. It does not revert in the Jubilee. The houses of the villages, however, which have no surrounding wall, shall be considered as open fields. They have redemption rights and revert in the Jubilee. Now, here we have a distinction between urban property and rural property, with an exception of a one-year redemption period. If a buyer buys his land in the city, if it's a walled city, he gets to keep that land, and the seller can't get it back. The seller can't redeem it after the buyer has held the land, the house, for 1 year. I know in South Carolina, when I foreclosed on a couple of pieces of property when I was representing a bank, when I was a lawyer, and I discovered that the foreclosed on debtor, the owner of the house, had 2 years, and the legal right he had was literally in the statute called the right of redemption, just like here in Leviticus. He had 2 years instead of 1 year, and so the person, the institution, or the person who forecloses on a mortgage like that has got to wait 2 years before his title is clean. One cannot help but wonder what the purpose of this law was. Here's some suggestions from John Gill. This law would encourage people to settle in walled cities because they knew if they bought a house, waited a year, it would be theirs and they wouldn't lose it, and that would make the cities populous and strong. Also, after the year of redemption was over, the buyer could make long-term improvements without fear of having the property taken back from him. Also, this law would encourage aliens to settle down in cities because they could buy land and it could not be redeemed after a year, and so they would own the land in fee simple. So I guess the idea is cities is different. You got to have improvements on the land. You got to have less restraints on alienation. Anytime you look at the conflict between land and city, for example, in British history, the great conflict between the landed noble interest in the medieval times and as capitalism started spreading in the 1800s, the horrible conflict that happened between the middle classes, the Whigs, and the landed Tories is the stuff of legend. And of course, rural property law in England was tied now with entails and restraints on alienations, and the courts were constantly trying to get rid of restraints on alienation so that the capitalist economy could take off. Well, here in Israel, you've got an agricultural society. Restraints on alienation are not going to hurt the countryside, probably, during Israel's time. And again, remember, this law is only going to last till the time that Jesus comes. But on the other hand, you still have a chance for urban development when you look at the city. So that's how I would try to explain the purpose behind this law. Now, we go now to Leviticus 25, verses 32 through 34. As for cities of the Levites have a permanent right of redemption for the houses of the cities which are their possession. Now, we need to remember here that the Levites didn't have a tribe of their own. They only had cities, and they had outside the walls of their cities, they had a certain area given to them for pasture land, and these cities were scattered all over the various tribes of Israel. Now, this law here in verse 32 is an exception to the law we just read that said that a seller of a house in a city loses his right of redemption after a year. He can't get his house back. But the Levites, if they sell a house, they can get it back up until the year of Jubilee. They have a permanent right of redemption. Why? Because the houses, the cities, is all they've got. They don't have tribal land they can go back to. Verse 33, what therefore belongs to the Levites may be redeemed, and a house sale in the city of this possession reverts in the Jubilee. For the houses of the cities of the Levites are their possession among the sons of Israel. In other words, that's what they got. They got houses, and they're going to get their houses back like everybody else gets their tribal lands back. The law had to make an exception for the Levites because the Levites didn't have tribal lands like everybody did, like every other tribe did. Verse 34, Leviticus 25, but pasture fields of their city shall not be sold, for that is their perpetual possession. Now, the pasture fields, those are the lands that go around the cities. It says they shall not be sold. Now, there's a question of what does that mean exactly? Well, it sounds like option number one, they couldn't be sold at all, period. And that seems like that would be kind of rough on the Levites. But I think it's John Gill says the Levites own those pasture lands in common. And so it would make sense to keep the land around the cities in common. So an individual Levite who had a house in the city would have a place to put his cattle and his sheep and his flocks. And it would be bad if the pasture land was sold to somebody else who might restrict the Levite's right to use that pasture land for his flocks. So I think that's probably what it means. You can't sell it, period. Levites, that's it. James Fawcett Brown said that no, it means that the land cannot be sold to a non-Levite, but they could buy and sell among themselves, and that would assume that the property is not held in common but held individually. Well, that makes sense if that's true. Another option is that the land could not be sold permanently. It could be sold temporarily and then redeemed or taken back at Jubilee, just like the houses of the Levites. Could be that's what the law meant. You're not going to sell the land means you're not going to sell the land like non-Levites' houses in the cities that are sold permanently with no right of redemption. That's not going to happen with pasture fields. That could be. I'm not really sure what the law meant here, but at any rate, that pasture land is going to remain in the Levites' hands, whatever option you take. Now, let me briefly go through the passage in Numbers 35, verses 1 through 8, where the Levites got cities instead of land. You shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. Well, verse 2 says, you shall give the Levites cities to live in, and you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to live in, and their pasture land shall be for their cattle and for their herds and for all their beasts. Then it goes to the extent that the pasture lands extended outside the walls. I won't read that, but the six cities of special note that were given to the Levites are mentioned in verse 6. The cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be the six cities of refuge, which you shall give to the manslayer to flee to. In addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. All the cities which you give to the Levites shall be 48 cities. Now, the six cities of refuge, of course, were the cities that a manslayer who accidentally killed somebody to avoid getting killed by the kinsman avenger, the avenger of blood, could run to that city until the courts had a chance to adjudicate whether the murder was intentional or unintentional. So those are kind of famous. There were three on the east side of the Jordan River and three on the west side. Verse 8, Numbers 35 says this, as for the cities which you shall give from the possession of the sons of Israel, you shall take more from the larger and you shall take less from the smaller. In other words, the big tribes had to give more cities to the Levites and the small tribes gave less cities to the Levites. Now let's look once more at why the Levites had permanent rights to their property. They could always redeem the property, I should say. Had a permanent right of redemption for their property. John Gill says it's because they had no inheritance of the land. I've already mentioned that. They didn't get land like the other people. The Levites' position was precarious. They depended on free will offerings of the people, peace offerings, mainly, tithe offerings for festivals, first fruits, and that kind of thing. And all of that, all of those offerings depended on pure religion being extant in the land, as Adam Clark says. And how often did that occur? How often was their religion pure? And I think that's the real reason is for economic security of the Levites. That's why God gave the law like this, Some people say that no, it's because God wanted to favor the Levites because they were the ministers of pure religion. In other words, it's not economic reasons that God favored the Levites. It was religious reasons. We go now to Leviticus 25, verses 35 through 38. Now, in case a countryman of yours becomes poor and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God, that your countryman may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Now we're talking about a poor man who ends up where he can't support himself and he needs charity. Verse 35, it says, now in case of a countryman of yours becomes poor. Now, that probably refers to a poor man who became poor through no fault of his own. I suspect very strongly that's what it means, because if somebody drinks himself half to death, you can't expect people to give charitable loans to such a person. I guess it's as in the case of all charity, there's always that question. Somebody's got to make a decision. I guess if the poor man took a countryman of his to court and says, the law says I'm supposed to be supported, the judges would have to make a decision on that. Now, verse 35 says you are to sustain him, the poor person, like a stranger or sojourner. To me, that seems strange. It seems like it would be you are to sustain a stranger or sojourner like an Israelite, not you're supposed to sustain this poor Israelite like a stranger or sojourner. But I think what it means is that if you have a stranger or sojourner, they're more likely to need financial help. Let's say there's a resident alien living in your house as a boarder. He's not going to have crops and lands, most probably, or business. He's going to need help more often, and so you would have to help him out. Now, I've been an alien and a stranger in China for 23 years. I don't want to tell you something. Foreigners need help. Now, we had ATMs that we'd get money out from our bank accounts in America and so forth, but still, gosh, they constantly need help. I need to buy this. I can't understand the language. I can't understand what's going on here. I don't understand the bureaucracy. You just constantly need help when you're an alien in a strange land. So this poor Israelite is going to be helped just like a stranger or a sojourner is going to help, that he may live with you. In other words, so that he doesn't have to leave the land of Canaan and thus be subjected to the temptations of idolatry. We want him to be sustained in the land of Israel. Don't let him run off into another country trying to make his living. Do not take usurious interest from him. The NIV note says don't take excessive interest from him. I'm going to suggest to you that that is not a good translation. Leviticus 25:36 in the Holman Christian Study Bible says do not profit or take interest from him. It doesn't say usurious interest. It just says don't take interest. And this is what it means, is you don't take interest, period. Whatever you call it, usurious interest, is not don't take excessive interest, but you can take a little bit of interest from him. No, you got 0%. That's what it means, 0%. So if you lend to a poor person, you give him the interest on the loan for free. You get the principal back. So the principal is not given to the poor person, but the interest that normally would have been gotten if it had been a business loan, that is donated to the poor person. Now what that does is that the giver is part of the charitable operation, and so is the receiver. He's got some skin in the game. He's got to behave as responsible as he can so he can pay the principal back. And this is the principle I think Habitat for Humanity uses. They say, yeah, we'll give you a new house, but by golly, you're going to have to work on it. That maintains the dignity of the poor person. He's not 100% on the dole, but it also gives him some charity that a normal person wouldn't get. A person who's got means would have to pay that interest back, but not the poor person in the case of a charity loan. And that's what we're going to call this, a charity loan. It's a loan because it mentions usurious interest, so it's a loan. You should not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. Why? Verse 38, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Of course, Egypt is the contrast to the land of Canaan. Egypt's the land of slavery. Canaan is the land of milk and honey. And the point here is Israelites are supposed to be living in the land of milk and honey, and a poor Israelite can't be eating milk or honey if he's poor, so help him out. Now, this Old Testament prohibition against usury was only meant for charitable loans. And it is amazing to me the economic ignorance of the Middle Ages, or of Islam for that matter, because even today they cannot give loans at interest to a business, which is has nothing to do with this. This is charity, not business. I know, I think it's in the Midwest somewhere where a bunch of Muslims have moved into America, and there's Islamic Bank. And this is years ago, I was reading a website about how this bank did it. They, of course, made business loans, but they couldn't charge nominal interest. But they had ways of getting their interest back, but it just wasn't obvious. Sneaky ways of doing it. They did the same thing in the Middle Ages, because it is a violation of the laws of economics to ask people to lend money and not get interest back on it. It's plain stupidity. And yet, how many times, if you read medieval history, people complain over and over and over about no money, no usury, no usury. Strange. It's sad, really. Now, interest on a business loan, as I said, is obviously allowed, and I'm going to give you some quotes just to back me up on that. Here's from John Gill. Quote, "This is to be understood of persons in poor and necessitous circumstances, of which the text only speaks. Otherwise, if persons borrow money to gain by it, to carry on a greater trade, or to make purchase with it, it is but reasonable that the lender should have a share of profit arising from thence." Of course, it's reasonable. Here's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's quotation. Quote, "The prohibition cannot be considered as applicable to the modern practice of men in business, borrowing and lending at legal rates of interest." Now, let's note verse 38. "I am the Lord your God." That refrain is put at the end of a lot of chapters in Leviticus. This emphasizes the point that God wants his laws obeyed. I am the Lord your God, so obey my laws. If anybody wants a reason for why the law should be obeyed, this is the conclusive answer. Because I'm God. You listen to me. Like when you're a two-year-old kid and you keep putting your hand in the cookie jar and you say, "Why, mommy? Why can't I put my hand in the cookie jar?" Because I'm your parent, son. That's why. We go to Leviticus 25, verses 39 through 43. "If your brother among you becomes destitute and sells himself to you, you must not force him to do slave labor. Let him stay with you as a hired hand or temporary resident. He may work for you until the year of Jubilee. Then he and his children are to be released from you, and he may return to his clan and his ancestral property. They are not to be sold as slaves, because they are my slaves that I brought out of the land of Egypt." The "they" is a little bit confusing. It's referring to the poor man who sold himself as a slave and his children. "They are not to be sold as slaves, because they are my slaves that I brought out of the land of Egypt. You are not to rule over them harshly, but fear your God." Now, this man in verse 39 is so poor, he's destitute. That's really poor. He's so poor that a charity loan won't save him from his distress. The charity loan that was just mentioned in the previous verses. So now it's worse than that. He's got to sell himself as a slave to somebody. But now, if he has to do that, he does not do slave labor. And you'll see here, there's a distinction between slave labor and the labor of a hired hand or temporary resident. Let's say a temporary resident, an alien who's staying in your house, renting some property. Maybe he might be doing some chores around the house. A hired hand might be doing the same thing. Maybe working on the farm. Maybe doing some handicraft work. That's not slave labor. But slave labor is stuff that's demeaning, that would let the public know that the impoverished Hebrew was a slave. For example, carrying his master's vessels or instruments to the bath, or loosening the master's shoes, as John Gill says, that would show that that's servile labor, slave labor. And Hebrews were not to be treated as slaves, and so you couldn't do that. He would be a slave legally, but he couldn't be treated like one. Here's a quote from John Gill. Quote, "Bondmen were put to the hardest service, the greatest drudgery, as well as what was mean and reproachful, and were used in the most rigorous and despotic manner, and were obliged to serve forever and were never released." Well, that's not going to happen to a Hebrew slave. He shouldn't be doing a slave labor, because he could be redeemed at any time by a kinsman, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said, and not to mention the seven-year period that rolls around, or the year of Jubilee rolls around, and he's free. So don't treat him like, don't make him be doing slave labor. So you see, the law is very solicitous of people who are poor. And I want to, having been poor at one time in my life, and not knowing where my next meal was going to come from, I want to tell you something. I hate poverty, and I love it when the law here says that the poor are going to be protected as much as possible. Now, of course, there's nothing said in here about it being sinful to be rich. Of course not. Only idiot Marxist or socialist would say that. But for people of means are supposed to take care. If they have to buy a fellow Hebrew, well, the money that they supply helps pay that Hebrew's debt, and then he treats him nice until he's redeemed. And then he basically becomes like an indentured servant or a worker. Now, a few odds and ends here. Then he and his children, the impoverished slave Hebrew, and his children are to be released. Now, it doesn't say that the children were sold into slavery along with their father. In fact, they weren't, according to John Gill, but the father was obliged to maintain them as they came over into the household. God says in verse 32, the reason you're going to treat these Israelite slaves so good, they're not to be sold as slaves. In other words, they can be redeemed because they are my slaves. You're not to rule over my slaves harshly. Selling them as slaves, I think what is meant in verse 42 is selling them as slaves to a foreign nation or something where they're permanently in slavery, not to one of their kinsmen Hebrews, but selling them out to where they're slaves forever. You know, there's one thing I've noticed about the pro-slavery defense in the antebellum South was that the Old Testament law allowed slavery, which it did, of course, but of course it allowed polygamy, and that's not here today, but it did allow slavery, but the slaves could be bought out. They could be redeemed. They could become voluntary slaves after 7 years, or they could just walk free. And when they walked free, the masters had to give them some money to get out. So I don't think the analogies that were being made by the pro-slavery argument fit the Bible. And remember, all this is done away with when Jesus comes back anyway. This is, you know, God doesn't like polygamy, but he was regulating polygamy. It's just like we don't like prostitution. I guess we don't like it in America. I'm scared to say that anymore. But we try to regulate it. And just because we're regulating the red light districts doesn't mean we approve of the red light districts. And that doesn't mean that God approves of polygamy or he approves of slavery. It's just that's the way people live and he had to regulate it. Just like divorce, he had to regulate it. Just like divorce. God doesn't approve of divorce, but there are divorce laws in the Old Testament. Now, one more interesting thing here. It says, and I don't know if I have the answer to this, it says that the slave, the Hebrew slave, can work for you, his brother Hebrew, master, until the year of Jubilee. Well, what happens if the seven-year period rolls around? Remember, slaves could only be held for 7 years. What if it rolls around before the year of Jubilee? Well, I assume that that law would kick in, that freedom, that sabbatical year, that seventh year would be in effect, and the slave would be free before the year of Jubilee. Also, vice versa, if the year of Jubilee rolls around before the seventh year, then the slave is free. He gets out of jail a little bit early. Verse 43 says, you're not to treat your Hebrew slaves harshly. John Gill describes that as, quote, treating them with great severity, laying hard and heavy tasks and burdens upon them that they could not bear, enjoining them things they could not perform, and ordering them to do what were unnecessary and without any limitation with respect to time. In other words, just a harsh taskmaster. Everybody knows what that is. You've got a boss like that. Leviticus 25, verses 44 through 46. Your male and female slaves are to be from the nations around you. You may purchase male and female slaves. You may also purchase them from the foreigners staying with you or from their families living among you, those born in your land. These may become your property. You may leave them to your sons after you to inherit his property. You can make them slaves for life. No right of redemption. Not 7 years. No year of Jubilee. For life. But concerning your brothers, the Israelites, you must not rule over one another harshly. So there was rights of redemption for Israelite slaves, but not for foreign slaves who were bought by the Hebrews. Now, of course, I can hear people saying, well, that's not fair. Remember, slavery was the labor system back then. The Israelites needed slavery. What's your option? You go in there and you conquer the Canaanites, and then you say, okay, I'm just going to kill you. What would a Canaanite prefer, to be killed or to be a slave? He'd prefer to be a slave. Or what if the Canaanite army was conquered and the Canaanite soldier would be made a POW? They didn't have POW camps, but the soldier could either be slain, killed, or he could be a slave. So he's a slave. But there is a lesson to be shown here. You're in the people of God, and assuming they're operating according to God's law, even the bad things aren't as bad. But by golly, if you're out there in the sinful, Molech-worshipping, Milcom-worshipping pagans, your slavery's worse. Now, the slaves could come from the nations around the Israelites. What nations were those? Well, there's the Ammonites and the Moabites. The Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites going from north to south on the east of the Dead Sea, and then Syrians to the northeast of Israel. You could get slaves from them, but that would not include getting slaves from the Canaanite nations, who are not really around the Israelites. They're among the Israelites. And the reason I say that is because Deuteronomy 20:16 says that all these Canaanite nations were to be destroyed, Deuteronomy 20:16. However, you must not let any living thing survive among the cities of these people the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance.
Of course, the Israelites didn't do that. They took forever to wipe out the Canaanites. They disobeyed, in other words, but the law is not going to tell them they can get slaves from these Canaanites. They were supposed to kill them. The Israelites could purchase slaves from foreigners staying with you, that's resident aliens, or foreigners just in for a short visit, or from their families living among you, foreigners or their families, including those who were born in the land. In other words, a resident alien could have kids. Well, you can buy those for a slave. If they get poor, they need to sell themselves for slavery, then you can buy them for life. Now, these foreign slaves owned by Hebrews could be passed down as property because they were slaves for life. There was no right of redemption, and so somebody could receive that slave in a will, and the slave would not be redeemed out of his possession. But concerning your brothers, the Israelites, you must not rule over one another harshly. That's a repeat from verse 43. Now we move on to Leviticus 25, verses 47 through 49. If a foreigner or temporary resident living among you prospers, but your brother living near him becomes destitute and sells himself to the foreigner living among you, or to a member of the foreigner's clan, now these verses are the opposite situation, where it's the foreigner who's well off and the Hebrew becomes so poor that he needs to sell himself into slavery, and so he sells himself to the rich foreigner. And it says your brother living near him, they're probably neighbors. Verse 48, he, that's the person who sold himself in slavery, the Hebrew who sold himself into slavery to the foreigner, he has the right of redemption after he's been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him. His uncle or cousin may redeem him, or any of his close relatives from his clan may redeem him. If he prospers, he may redeem himself. If he ends up with enough money that he can get himself out of hock, he can redeem himself, and the foreigner has to let him go. Now, there's a question here. This is a minor point, but it says in verse 47, if a foreigner or temporary resident living among you prospers, what's the difference between a foreigner and a temporary resident? A temporary resident is a foreigner. Are there other foreigners who are not temporary residents? Well, one way you can read that is there's no distinction. It's just a repetition, two different ways of saying the same thing, a foreigner who is a temporary resident. Or you could say a foreigner is just someone who's in Israel for a brief visit, but a temporary resident actually lives in Israel doing business, might even live here long enough to get married and have kids, but he's not a citizen of Israel. And in this situation, the Hebrew slave, if he sells himself to a foreigner, has the right of redemption. He can get out either on the seventh year or the year of Jubilee, or if somebody, a kinsman redeemer pays the money to redeem him, or if he redeems himself, he can get out of slavery. But the converse wasn't true. An alien couldn't do all that. An alien slave, enslaved to a Hebrew citizen, the alien slave could not redeem himself, could not have a kinsman redeemer to redeem himself, did not have the year of Jubilee rolling around to free him, or the seventh year after the purchase of a slave to redeem him, to release him from slavery. There were privileges to being a member of God's chosen people. We go now to Leviticus 25, verses 50 through 52. The one who purchased him, that's the kinsman redeemer, is to calculate the time. Remember, we just talked about the kinsman redeemer in the last verses, someone who redeemed the Hebrew slave. And so verse 50, when it says the one who purchased him, is talking about the kinsman redeemer who purchased the Hebrew slave, is to calculate the time from the year he sold himself to him, from the year that the Hebrew slave sold himself to the kinsman redeemer. Now this is confusing because of all the he's that aren't clear, the antecedents of which are not clear. So let me read it again the right way. The kinsman redeemer who purchased the Hebrew slave, who redeemed the Hebrew slave, is to calculate the time from the year the Hebrew slave sold himself to the kinsman redeemer until the year of Jubilee. I assume the reason it says sold himself, the Hebrew slave sold himself at the time of his redemption by the kinsman redeemer, is because the kinsman redeemer is now the master. Instead of the foreigner, the alien being the master, the kinsman redeemer is the master. Now, how much is the kinsman redeemer going to pay for this redemption price so he can get his Hebrew slave? Well, it tells us in these verses that the price is calculated depending on how many years are left of the year of Jubilee, and the easiest way to explain this is to take an example. Let's say that the Hebrew slave was originally purchased by the foreigner, the alien, for 100 shekels. Now, from that purchase date, not the redemption date now, but the purchase date to Jubilee is 5 years. So we know that the price of a slave decreases every year by 20 shekels every year that's left until the year of Jubilee. Because if anybody buys a slave, they have the value of the slave for less number of years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, 0 years. So every year, the value of the slave goes down 20 shekels. All right, now let's assume that 2 years after the purchase date, remember the purchase date is 5 years away from Jubilee, so 2 years later, 3 years left the Jubilee, a kinsman redeemer wants to buy the slave, redeem the slave. Well, there's 3 years left to the year of Jubilee, 20 shekels a year, that's 60 shekels. So the kinsman redeemer pays 60 shekels to the alien slave owner. Now, he's not hurt. He paid 100 shekels for the slave. He only gets 60 back, but he got 2 years of labor plus the 60 shekels. I'm assuming the 2 years of labor are worth approximately the cost of the slave for 1 year. The labor that a slave could do for 1 year is equal to a proportional amount of value. So the slave owner got 2 years of labor plus 60 shekels. That's for a total value of 100 shekels. Everybody's happy. Now, it does say here that it will be set for him like the daily wages of a hired hand. I don't think the current wage rate had anything to do with the redemption price. I think the text here just means that the redemption price is fixed, just like wages are fixed. In other words, people have to fix wages, and so now we have to fix the redemption price. This is how we do it. I don't think the daily wage rate. I've seen some commentators who do say that somehow the wages are, but I think it's the value of the slave is what is used as the base to multiply by the percentage of years that are left until the year of Jubilee. We go now to Leviticus chapter 25, verses 53 through 55. He will stay with him. That's the Hebrew slave will stay with him, the alien slave owner. The slave will stay with the slave owner like a man hired year by year. A foreign owner is not to rule over him, over the Hebrew slave, harshly in your sight. If he is not redeemed in any of these ways, namely by the kinsman redeemer or himself, he and his children are to be released at the year of Jubilee, for the Israelites are my slaves. They are my slaves that I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. They are my slaves. They are not yours. And I take care of my slaves, and by golly, you're going to take care of them too. That's kind of the idea behind verse 55. That's a repeat verse 2. Now, it says in verse 53, the Hebrew slave will stay with the foreign master like a man hired year by year. So the slave is just going to be like a hired man who could leave at any time. Just like the hired man could leave at any time, a Hebrew slave could be redeemed at any time, as John Gill says. Verse 53 says he will stay with him. The Hebrew slave will stay with him. You might want to think that's the kinsman redeemer who redeemed him. But no, it's talking about the alien slave owner. He will stay with the alien slave owner like a man hired year by year. A foreign owner is not to rule over him. The context is foreign owner. Ladies and gentlemen, we finished with Leviticus 25, which is somewhat of a complicated chapter. The last half of it is, as I'm sure you will agree, we are now prepared to move ahead to Leviticus 26. We're going to look at the consequences of obedience and disobedience. This is the blessing and cursings chapter, similar to Deuteronomy 28. Hope you stay tuned for that audio. Hope you enjoyed this one.